To dream the impossible dream.
Hi, I'm Michelle Feinblum. I'm lucky to be one of the TFs for this class. And I wanted to let folks know about opportunities to learn more about transcendental meditation. That's one of the techniques that Tal had talked about in his meditation lectures, one of the first brought over from the East and popularized in this country. I've been practicing TM since I was not quite 15, which is more than a few years ago. Along with my parents, my sisters, lots of aunts and uncles, my grandmother who ended up living to be 100, don't know if that was why, and nieces, nephews, etc. So very familiar with the technique and its benefits. There have been over 600 research studies published on TM, so it's by far the most widely researched technique. available. And I've been talking to one of the local TM teachers about the opportunity to have folks here have a lecture presented to them. And so we talked about different options. And I know this is a really, really busy time of year. So I wanted to get a sense for when and where might be convenient for folks to see it who are interested. So I'm just going to take a poll. This is completely independent of any credit you get for the course. This is just your interest. First of all, sort of just a poll on who thinks that they may have the opportunity and interest in the next couple of weeks to see, I think it's like an hour-long lecture, get a sense of numbers. Okay, good. And then second of all, there's three venues we talked about. One is the Harvard Club in Boston. That has the most space of the different ones we discussed. Another is a space in Cambridge they can use, as well as space they can use in the Financial District in Boston. So of those, I don't know if we can get anything on campus. I haven't actually explored that. Or campus, okay? That does sound very convenient. Okay, good. Please raise your hand if you think in the next couple of weeks you could attend something on campus. I'd be interested in doing that. Okay, so lots of people. And how about the Harvard Club, lovely Harvard Club in Boston? Okay, not so many. And how about elsewhere on Cambridge? Okay, we can do campus, great. Okay, we'll do that. And then the next question is quickly, which is better for folks, days or evenings? Days, please, raise your hand. Evenings, raise your hand. Okay, good, pretty straightforward. I'll be sending out email.
Thanks. It's all right, fine. Hi, good morning. Second last lecture. Yeah, but but it's a special lecture, fortunately. So imagine this. Courtesy of 1504, what we have found is a wonder drug. What if I told you now that after much research, years and years, decades of research, we have found this wonder drug. And this wonder drug will do the following. It will make you feel good. It will enhance your self-esteem. It will bring about calm and equanimity. Your thinking will become clearer. It will make you more attractive. And there are no negative side effects, so I don't think your parents would mind if you take it. It's legal, I know, hard to believe, but it is. And it's free. If I'd offered you this drug, either in blue or red, would you take it? Okay. Well, so today I'm going to offer you a blue, red, and pink drugs. In fact, a cocktail of three drugs. Taken together, it's even more powerful than taken alone. And they're all legal. They have no side effects other than positive ones. And they're free. What we're going to talk about today is the mind-body connection. And we've talked about it throughout the semester. So we talked about, for example, how our mind affects our body. If we're more optimistic, we'll be healthier, we're even more likely to live longer. If we cultivate our resilience, It will also cultivate our physical resilience to disease, strengthen our immune system. We saw how gratitude, keeping a gratitude journal, or those who keep it are less likely to visit the doctor's office over a period of 6 months while this study was done. So we have seen how the mind influences the body. What we'll talk about today is how the body can directly influence the mind. And this is related to the topic we've been discussing throughout the semester, attitudes versus behaviors, and how attitudes influence behaviors, mind, body, and how behaviors influence attitudes, body and mind. And we've seen it, again, through optimism, when we talked about yoga, when we talked about resilience, merit finding, and so on. So what are we going to do today? We're going to talk about three things. First, the importance of exercise, one of the most powerful interventions when it comes to physical as well as mental health. We'll talk about the importance of sleep. Some of you may even do it over the next hour. And then we'll talk about touch. Some of you, yeah. So, and there's a very simple message here today in this lecture. First, I would like to get you to exercise more. Second, to sleep more outside of class. And third, to touch more, if you're not already doing a lot of this. But the first thing, before we can incorporate these things into our lives, I want to go back to something we talked about halfway through the semester, the importance of simplifying. Because in order to introduce these things into our lives, we very often have to get rid of other things. 24 hours in a day, and if we want to sleep our 8 hours, if we want to do exercise for an hour a day, and if we want to have time for hugs, then we need sometimes to say no to different things. So simplify. But once we simplify, let's move on to what our body can do to our mind. Unfortunately, in the West especially, there is a real disconnect between the mind and the body. The disconnect can be traced back most significantly to the birth of modern philosophy, specifically the person considered the father of modern philosophy, René Descartes. Descartes talked about the mind and the body being two separate and irreconcilable entities that we need to study individually. They don't go hand in hand. And this Cartesian dualism has been taken into most of what we do today, because Descartes is also considered the father of the scientific revolution. He, alongside with Francis Bacon, brought about a lot of good things, but this is one of the negative side effects of the scientific revolution, where on the one hand, we have, for instance, psychology, the realm of the mind. And if we want to, quote unquote, fix the mind, we need to focus on the mind. On the other hand, you have medicine. And if we want to fix the body, we do it while ignoring, to a great extent, the mind. In the past few decades, fortunately, more medical doctors as well as psychologists have taken up the cause of merging between the two, because they realize how important it is, both for physical health and to mental health. Antonio Damasio, in his book, Descartes' Error, has the following to say about the dualism. This is Descartes' error. The abyssal separation between body and mind, between the sizable, dimensioned, mechanically operated, infinitely divisible body stuff, on the one hand, and the unsizable, undimensional, unpush-pullable, non-divisible mind stuff. The suggestion that reasoning and moral judgment and the suffering that comes from physical pain or emotional upheaval might exist separately from the body. And he goes on throughout his book, through psychology and philosophy, to create a bridge. And this course is very much about bridging. Unfortunately, Cartesian dualism has penetrated into psychology. I'm taking this term, pure psychology, borrowing it or paraphrasing what Immanuel Kant talked about when he talked about pure reason. Similar idea, reason devoid of emotion. Psychology that doesn't talk about our physiology at all, but only about the brain. And the mind alone can only take us so far. For example, psychoanalysis, the talking cure, extremely important, yields results. So cognitive behavioral therapy, and we saw the power of these interventions. However, they can only take us so far, and there is a limit that we can do without the body. At the same time, when we only focus on the body, as very often Western medicine does, we're also compromising on the potential for healing, on potential for health. And what we need to do, as we've done throughout the semester, is build bridges, particularly two bridges here first, between East and West. There's a lot that the West can learn from the East when it comes to reconciling mind and body, yin and yang, heart and mind. At the same time, there's also a lot that the East can learn from the West. A lot of the medical advancements brought about by modern science. So we need to create a bridge, the best of both worlds. And also between psychology and medicine. There's a lot that medicine can get from psychology and vice versa. Fortunately, there are some doctors and some psychologists who have taken up this cause. One of them, for instance, one of them that I find most fascinating, in fact, unbelievable, is the work of Dr. Sarno, S-A-R-N-O, from New York University Medical School. What he showed is that about 90% of back problems are a result of a psychological phenomenon. For example, he was able to cure people when they recognized that there are certain emotions that they are suppressing. How does that work? For instance, let's say I feel jealousy. It feels bad to feel jealousy. I don't want to feel it, so I suppress it. But it needs an outlet somewhere. And that outlet is often physical, whether it's in the form, as Sarno says, of backache, shoulder ache, carpal tunnel syndrome, or headaches. Or if I feel anger or sadness, very often this anger or sadness manifests itself in the body. Again, backache or whatever. Why? Because it needs an outlet. And why does it manifest itself physically? Because there is much more of a stigma when it comes to mental dis-ease than when it comes to physical dis-ease. But because it needs an outlet and we don't let it out, when we say, okay, I'm feeling sad, I'm angry, I'm jealous, I'm upset, when we don't let it out, it manifests itself physically. In other words, it's when we don't give ourselves the permission to be human that very often these emotions lead to physical ailments, to physical dis-ease. When I say it's unbelievable, it really is unbelievable. There's a lot of research that Dr. Sarno and others have conducted showing how many backaches can actually and have been actually cured by just telling the people, well, acknowledge these emotions. Don't fight them, just acknowledge them, and the backache goes away. Those of you in 1508 saw Tony Schwartz, who was here literally running up and down the stage. He had severe backache. He was before an operation until he met Dr. Sarno. It was 25 years ago. He hasn't had backache since. And there are thousands of such stories. The mind influencing the body. And there are other people. Herbert Benson from the medical school here, his best-known book is The Relaxation Response, talks about meditation. We discussed his work. In his book, Timeless Healing, he says, I view health and well-being as a three-legged stool. One leg is pharmaceuticals, a second leg is surgery and procedures. We have at our disposal awesome medications and surgeries. Many of us would not be alive today without them. Yet we need a third leg, self-care. This includes the relaxation response, spirituality, nutrition, exercise, and stress management. Unfortunately, we're trying to use the first two legs, the surgery or the pharmaceuticals, to deal with stress-related issues where they don't work. It has to be a balance of all three legs. Now, Benson is certainly not calling for getting rid of modern medicine. He himself is a doctor, certainly believes in it, but he says that we need a balance. Just like we need a balance between conventional psychology and positive psychology, similar here, we need a balance, a three-legged stool. The problem is that in modern medicine, what has happened very often is that the baby was thrown out with the bathwater. The bathwater, witch doctors, or mysticism, a mystical approach, unscientific approach to healing. But when that went out, with the advent of modern science, very often what went with it was the power of the mind. So what Benson talks about are things like the placebo effect and how powerful the mind can be while healing the body. And we talked about it when we talked about beliefs as self-fulfilling prophecies. There are also psychologists who recognize the importance of bridging mind and body. Jon Kabat-Zinn, whose research we read for the Meditation Week on mindfulness, in his book Full Catastrophe Living, which is a phrase taken from the book Zorba the Greek, says, perhaps the most fundamental development in behavioral medicine is the recognition that we can no longer think about health as being solely a characteristic of the body or the mind, because body and mind are interconnected. So it's again people like Jon Kabat-Zinn, psychologist, Nathaniel Brandon, psychologist, Tara Bennett-Goldman, psychologist, and then on the other side, Herbert Benson, John Sarno, Antonio Damasio, people who come more from the science side and recognizing the interrelatedness. In our world today, we do not exercise enough. Give me 1 second. Before I go into exercise. What we see in our world today is a divide, which is related to the mind-body divide, between action and reflection. On the one hand, we have Socrates who says that the unexamined life is not worth living. And there's some truth to that in this course, very much focused on reflection, on the importance of reflection. Thinking about ideas, thinking about what I really want to do with my life, asking the three-question process. Reflecting on the positive things in our lives through the gratitude journal, and so on. Thinking about what will make me really, really happy. An examination is important. However, there is also such a thing as over-examination. I fell into this trap where I found that I was living the examination more than I was living life. And as a psychologist, it's very easy to fall into this trap. And therefore, in this class, we often talked about putting reflection aside and just being, The permission to be human is about not analyzing or overanalyzing why I'm feeling upset, why I'm anxious, why I'm sad. It's simply experiencing these emotions, experiencing the gift of the present. Mindfulness meditation is not about reflection. It's about being in the here and now. There's a significant place for that. But what we need to find is the balance. For a happy life, we cannot lead an unexamined life. We're just not constituted that way. Maybe a cow grazing in the field can, we cannot. But on the other hand, we also don't want to go overboard and continuously, constantly analyze things, because that becomes rumination, and that's unhealthy too at times. We need to find the right balance. David Watson, who wrote in the Handbook of Positive Psychology about the mind-body, says, studies of short-term mood indicate that positive affect is more related to action than thought, such that it is easier to induce a state of high positive affect through doing than through thinking. Two broad classes of activity are particularly conducive to elevated positive mood: socializing and interpersonal behavior, and exercise and physical activity. So we spend a lot of time talking about relationships and its importance. And the second thing that he talks about, exercise and activity. Not enough just to do that, but certainly for short-term feeling better, and over time, if we persist, also for long-term happiness. Exercise is important, especially today. We don't exercise a lot today. We don't need to. Most of us have the quote-unquote, and I'm putting it in quotes, luxury of not having to go on a wild chase so that we can serve goose for the main course, or to go out to the field and collect berries for dessert. We don't need to do it. We have it all ready-made for us. We don't need to go out to the street, to the woods, and chop the fuel for our fireplace. We press a button. We go to the dining hall, and everything is served for us. The problem is that this very much is associated with the rising levels of depression that we see in our society. Why? Because we need to exercise, just like we need air, water, and food. We have a physical need for this, and when we frustrate a need, we always inevitably pay a price. Remember Francis Bacon, nature to be commanded must be obeyed. Our nature is such, whether through evolution, through God, our nature is such that it needs the physical exercise. It needs to run. We need to use our muscles, and when we only use our finger muscles, that's not enough, no matter how fast we type. Seneca, 2,000 years ago, our forefathers lived every jot as well as we when they provided and dressed their own meat with their own hands, lodged upon the ground, and were not as yet come to the vanity of gold and gems. That was 2,000 years ago. Today, we can live in greater luxury. This is about the upper class that he was talking about. They had slaves at the time doing the physical work for them. Today, with modernity and with technology, we're able to lead lives that royalty couldn't have lived in terms of luxury only 100 or 200 years ago, not to mention 2,000 years ago. And we pay a price for it. We pay a very dear price, as we'll see in a minute. But before we go into the price, the important thing to realize is that we have a choice. Our choice is to go out to Harvard Yard and start chasing geese, or start chasing boars, or imaginary windmills, and that will help. Or we can exercise, because in our modern world, we don't do it enough.
lazy. We have buttons doing everything for you. There's no physical activity attached to anything anymore. Even the garage door opener. We used to have to get out of the car and open up the garage door. Now there's a button you push, you know? And the car window. This became too much. This, I don't want to churn butter. I just want fresh air. We still use that gesture if we want somebody to roll their window down in traffic. We still use that, even though nobody's got it. Because we'd look like idiots if we did this. Even we used to have breath mints. Now we have breath strips. They just dissolve on our tongue for us. How lazy. Can we not suck anymore? Put it on. I'm tired. I had a hard day.
Let's look at some research that Ellen DeGeneres is basing her argument on. Research done by Bank and her colleagues at Duke Medical School shows the effect of exercise. Let me describe this, this study, which was a landmark study that has since been replicated many times. She took in 156 patients with major depressive disorder. These people, according to the DSM-4, had depressed mood, sense of worthlessness, physiological consequences such as difficulty falling asleep, inability to enjoy things, and they have it over an extended period of time. Major depressive. They took 156 of them and divided them into three random groups. One group was exercise, where they exercise for 30 minutes, three times a week, aerobic exercise. This could either be jogging, brisk walking, swimming, or in the gym. Aerobic exercise, three times a week for 30 minutes. The second group was on medication only. Not just any medication, they were on Zoloft, the second most common antidepressant. The third group, both exercise and Zoloft. They followed this group for 16 weeks, 4 months. Just exercise, medicine, and exercise, and just medicine. And here is what they found. All groups improved. More than 60% within each group actually became better when it was no longer classified as clinically depressed after the four months. No significant difference among the groups, except for one difference. It took the exercising groups longer to get out of their depression within the 4 months. The Zoloft kicked in more rapidly. However, once the exercise kicked in, about a month into the study, there was no difference. In other words, it's not as quick a fix, but it was a fix. Now here's the interesting part. 10 months follow-up, so for 6 months after they stopped taking the medication. Here are the results in terms of relapse. Those only on medication, 38% relapsed to their depressive state. Relapse of the medication and exercise, significantly less, 31%. Relapse relapse of the exercise-only group. 9%. Now that's remarkable. Why? Well, you could say because those people exercising have a sense of agency. I did it myself. I can do it again. I don't need something external to help me get over it. Now, this doesn't mean, and I'll repeat this a few times, this doesn't mean Zoloft doesn't have, or Prozac, or Ritalin, or whatever it is, doesn't have important effect. It does. And sometimes it's the only thing that can help. However, before we go in that direction, we would also do well to first of all try this natural wonder drug. More research. Dysthymia, which is less acute, but more prolonged depression. Three groups, once again. The first group was a control group. a control group, dysthymia continued. The second group was a relaxation group. Their condition improved. So they did the breathing meditation exercises, relaxation, conditions improved. The group that improved most dramatically by far is the exercise group. By far. Now, when I looked at these studies, I said to myself, wow, this is amazing. And the way it was in my mind, I said to myself, okay, so running or exercising of any sort is like an antidepressant. It's as powerful as Zoloft, sometimes more. It's like an antidepressant, also reduces anxiety, as we'll see shortly. Powerful antidepressant drug. And then I thought about it some more and I realized that it wasn't. Exercising is not like taking an antidepressant. Rather, not exercising is like taking a depressant. This is not just different, you know, use of words. This is a very significant difference because, you see, we weren't made to not exercise. We weren't made to be sedentary. We weren't made to just exercise our fingers or our vocal cords. We were made to run. We were made to exert effort. And what happens when we don't exercise? We compromise on our natural state of well-being. So if this is my natural base level of happiness, when I don't exercise, this becomes my base level of happiness. So in other words, once I start exercising 3 times a week for 30 minutes or however long, what happens is simply that I go up to what is natural to me, my base level of well-being. And very often what we're using drugs for in our sedentary world, in our modern luxurious world, is to get us up from what is actually unnatural to us to what can be our daily existence. Again, it's not a panacea, and I'll talk about it some more in a minute, but it certainly can help a lot. Let's look at other benefits of exercising. In terms of psychological well-being, the mind, enhanced levels of self-esteem, this is both state self-esteem, so we feel better about ourselves right after we exercise, and also trait self-esteem. Over time, if we exercise regularly, our levels of self-esteem go up. Lowers our levels of anxiety as well, right after we exercise, as well as our base level of anxiety, state and trait. It has been successfully used as an adjunctive treatment in conjunction with psychotherapy or medication. For instance, in the treatment, successfully used in the treatment of schizophrenia, psychosis, neuroses, very often supplementing therapy or medication with exercise helps more than without. It also clears our mind. It also improves our memory. This was done especially with older adults. It improves memory. Some of the physical benefits, weight loss or control, for the same reason or some analogous reason as this. Let's say we have a natural weight. When we don't exercise, when we're sedentary, we go above this natural weight, and then we need all these special diets and painful procedures in order to bring us down to our comfortable, ideal, and healthy weight. Obviously, I'm not talking here about becoming obsessed with it. We talked about it under perfectionism. But coming back to a healthy weight, most diets, over 90% of diets fail unless they're done in conjunction with exercise. It strengthens our immune system. And if nothing had convinced you until now to exercise, there's a book called Run for Life. It's about women, exercise, and sexuality. Women who exercise regularly have more sex and have better sex and are more likely to experience orgasms. For men as well, it helps in terms of having better sex, being more physically aroused for both men and women with regular exercise. Great, right? Yes, but it's not a fix-all. I wish it were. There is certainly a place for medication when necessary. There is certainly a place for therapy. In other words, there is a place for reflection. It's not just about action. Here are some exercise tips. It's important to supplement the aerobic exercise with some stretching, some strength training. It's important because we prevent injury that way, especially if we stretch after exercising. The important thing about exercise is a gradual buildup. As you know, today I can't play squash anymore for a simple reason, because I didn't adhere to this. I went straining, worked with John Shirkan. He was working 6 hours a day. I was doing it for 6 hours a day, and I got injured as a result. So there is a real importance for gradual buildup. As we'll talk about in a minute, divide and conquer. Begin with a 5-minute walk if you haven't been doing anything. Build up after 2 weeks to 10 minutes. Start jogging maybe lightly or swimming. We're much more likely to sustain exercise if we do it gradually. We also need some days off. There is such a thing as too much exercise. 5 days a week, probably optimal. And the reason is because our muscles, as you know, build up only when they rest. So when we exercise, they break down, and we need to give them time to build up again. Moreover, these 5 days shouldn't all be rigorous, hard exercise. So I'll give you an example of what I do. And again, through a lot years of trial and error, it may not be right for you. 3 times a week, I do 30 minutes of aerobic exercise. That could be something like running outside if I can. I also have a trampoline at home, the mini trampolines that I jump on. And as do you want to see? $35, certainly worth it. And also I do a lot of exercise bike, 30 minutes 3 times a week. In addition, I do yoga, as you know, 3 times a week. This is my exercise. So total of 6 days. But, the yoga exercise, I do Hatha yoga rather than power yoga. So it's a lot like stretching in terms of the physical aspects of it. The most important thing here is to listen to your body. Listen to your body. If something hurts, stop. Take time off. Again, I paid a very dear price when, you know, I didn't listen to my body when my ankle was hurting or my knee was hurting a bit or my back. I continued slugging through it. No pain, no gain. Listen to your body. It's better to do too little than too much. Because the quantity also influences the quality. For instance, if this is intensity, if you have intensity here, and let's say you have benefit here, the graph looks this way. It's a curvilinear relationship. If our intensity is too low, if we do too little, we don't benefit much. If we do too much, overtrain, we also don't benefit. In fact, it can have a deleterious effect, especially for those people, I'm talking now to the athletes here, who train very hard and push themselves to the limit. First of all, it is important to take time off. But also, once you graduate and you start doing your own, it doesn't mean that if you can get your pulse up to 200 and keep it there for 10 minutes, or 180 and keep it there for half an hour, it doesn't mean that it's better because it's harder. Or if you practice 6 or 7 days a week in the gym and do some sprints and do long distance, it doesn't mean that it's good for you. It can have the opposite effect. From the Handbook of Positive Psychology, Dins, Beer, and Zing. Repeated workouts that are too intense to allow complete recovery may cause endurance athletes to experience staleness, a syndrome that is characterized by increased psychological symptoms of anxiety with increased sympathetic nervous system, whatever that is, and it doesn't sound good though, and cortisol base rates. So exercise is good. It's really good for us when done the right amount. So why doesn't everyone do it? Why are most people sedentary? Why do most people exercise their finger muscles and little more beyond that? What are the barriers and how do we overcome them? The first barrier is that there is some pain and some discomfort associated with it. So even if you're at your optimal pulse, which is between 60 and 80% of your maximum, for most of you, maximum would be 200, so between 120 and 160 pulse, it's still not that comfortable. It is a little bit painful. So how do we overcome that? There are a few ways. First, by dividing and conquering. Build up gradually. Your body and your mind will get used to being at that pace for 30 minutes after a while. And then you can experience what many runners describe as the runner's high, even while doing it, within 5 or 10 minutes into it. Second, this is the thing that works for me, I must admit. The reason why I like the trampoline so much is because I can watch TV while doing it. Or I can talk to, you know, my son, my wife. I've even learned how to read while doing a trampoline. Not easy, but possible. The most important thing, if you're having problems sustaining exercise, is to get social support. And there are a lot of studies on this, and this is the number one predictor of whether people sustain practice or stop after a month or two, regardless of the resolution that they have on January 1 of that year. Social support is critical. Let me show you an example of how much social support can help. All right, so not quite that kind of support, but you know what I mean. Go with your friend to the gym. Go together to yoga. Make a commitment, because remember when we talked about procrastination? One way to overcome procrastination is to do it with other people, is to procrastinate with other people, is to go and train. It's much more fun, right, together than alone. Go to the gym together, make a commitment. And over longitudinal studies, what they found is that they're most likely to continue. And now people say, I want to do it, but I'm way, way too busy. I have way too much to do, too much work, too many commitments, too many student organizations that I'm running. I don't have time for this. Well, unfortunately, one of the first things to go when we feel under time pressure is exercising. And what I'd like to suggest is that it should be the last thing to go when you're under time pressure. Why? Because it is really an investment. If you put in just 30 minutes of exercise 3 times a week, it will actually not only make you happier, but more productive, so that you will get more done even though you have less time on your calendar because you just put down an hour or so for exercise. Remember, after my sophomore year, I played squash very hard that year and I was burnt out. And I didn't want to even look at a squash court anymore, and I didn't want to exercise anymore until the beginning of next season because I had no time. So even if when I felt recovered, I had no time. I had so many things to catch up. I mean, those of you who play a spring sport know how busy the season is and how difficult it is to then catch up. So our season ended. I stopped training. My mood was depressed. I didn't feel good about myself. I didn't feel good about being here. And I actually became less productive. As soon as I went back to exercising, even though I had, quote unquote, no time, I became much happier and also got a lot more done. So it's a good investment to exercise. And schedule it in advance. Now, we talked a lot about scheduling and making plans. I mean, we even talked about it in terms of relationships. Schedule a time together with your loved one, even if you're living with that person. Because when we don't, we end up not spending quality time with them. Because time, or rather activities, behave like gases do. The law of gases, you put a gas in a room, it expands to fill up the entire room. The same with activities. If you don't put time aside, the activities that you have right now will fill up your entire schedule. So put 3 times a week, no matter what, exercise. This is for your mental and physical hygiene. And just like you don't say, well, I won't brush my teeth or shower today because I have no time, you wouldn't say or should not say the same thing about exercising. Put time aside for it. Another barrier to exercise, and this is a significant one, and one which is more difficult to overcome, is our subconscious. Nathaniel Brandon talks about being worthy of happiness. Now, we know, there isn't much new that I told you. Maybe you didn't know the particular study that shows exercise and depression. We know that exercise is good for us. We know that we feel better when we exercise. We know that it makes us happier. And yet, very often, our subconscious comes in and says to us, you're not worthy of happiness. I'm not good enough to deserve this. Again, we talked about it a lot in the self-esteem lecture. And then self-verification theory comes in, the work by Swan on self-verification. And we say, well, if I don't deserve to be happy, then I want consistency. I won't be happy, and therefore I will not exercise. And our subconscious mind finds all different kinds of excuses, such as it's painful, such as I have no time to do it, such as I'm tired, and we don't do it, and we deprive ourselves of the ultimate currency. And we can overcome this. What's the best way to overcome it? Is by simply doing it. Just go the first 5 minutes and you'll get into it. Just start, even if you don't feel like it. Get on the trampoline or the treadmill or go outside or take a friend and go together to a yoga or an aerobics class. And just do it. And if we do it consistently enough, behavior changes attitude. The behavior is exercise. I care about myself, is the message that we communicate. I care about myself enough to take an hour a day that will help me feel better. Self-perception theory, BEM. I see myself exercising. I see myself taking care of myself. I begin to care for myself even more. And then I exercise more and I feel better about myself, and so on in an upward spiral. Overcoming the subconscious, I'm unworthy of happiness. And that's why exercise influences self-esteem, both the state level right now and also the trait level over time, because of the message that I'm communicating to myself. I'm important enough to put time aside to take care of myself. Many of us, especially at the university, may discard the body as less important. What's most important are the great thoughts that we think. Well, to think great thoughts, we also need ideally a healthy body. They work together. There is no disconnect. There shouldn't be a disconnect. There is no Cartesian dualism in reality. It's only a product of faulty thinking. Exercise is the unsung hero of positive psychology and of psychology in general. Professor Patrick Callahan has this to say in an article that you're reading for this week. There is evidence that exercise is beneficial for mental health. It reduces anxiety, depression, and negative mood, and improves self-esteem and cognitive functioning. Exercise is also associated with improvements in the quality of life of those living with schizophrenia. Remember the adjunct treatment. However, exercise is seldom recognized by mainstream mental health services as an effective intervention in the care and treatment of mental health problems. This is exactly what Herbert Benson said. We completely ignore the third stool, the third leg of the stool, and we pay a very high price for it. And when I say high price, I mean in the ultimate currency, in the currency of happiness, but I also mean in dollars and cents, billions and billions of dollars in healthcare, unnecessarily spent on things that could have been prevented by regular exercises. Professor of psychiatry at the medical school here, John Rady, in a way, exercise can be thought of as a psychiatrist's dream treatment. It works on anxiety, on panic disorder, and on stress in general, which has a lot to do with depression. And it generates the release of neurotransmitters, norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine, that are very similar to our most important psychiatric medicine. Having a bout of exercise is like taking a little bit of Prozac and a little bit of Ritalin right where it is supposed to go. This is the wonder drug. With very little effort, and again, after a while, we actually experience a high when we exercise. We can experience all these positive effects and go back to our base level of happiness that we're compromising on in today's luxurious modern world. Doesn't take much. Let me move on to another wonder drug. A couple of you have already taken it now. Sleep. Sleep deprivation has been described as an American epidemic. Before Edison, before the invention of the light bulb, the average American slept 10 hours a day. Wow. Indeed. Today, it's a little bit less than that, as you can imagine. Today, the average is 7 hours a day. And you're at your age, on average, most people don't get enough. Only 25% of 18 to 29-year-olds get what is for most people the optimal 8 hours. And it varies. It varies between usually between 7 and 10 hours optimum. Now, I want to do a quick survey here. And again, be honest. There's no reason not to. How many people here sleep per 24 hours, not just necessarily at night? You know, you can sleep, you know, 6 hours a night, and then 1 hour in lecture and another hour in the afternoon. How many people here sleep between 8 and 10 hours a night? Okay, it's pretty good. How many people sleep between 7 and 8 hours a night? How many people sleep between 6 and 7 hours a night? How many people are sitting here and thinking, they're all lying, they sleep like us, less than 6 hours a night? Okay. All right, that's pretty good. This semester has been, some of you know, very difficult for me in terms of juggling two very large courses, other things that happened around positive psychology. There are a few things I didn't compromise on, but two of them, I exercised religiously 3 times a week. I continued my mindfulness meditation / yoga practice, and I slept 8 hours a night. Unless, you know, there are issues with a baby, of course, that changes things. But in general, 8 hours a night. Why? Because sleep is a priority. It is also, in a sense, a wonder drug. Here are some of the effects of sleep. It strengthens our immune system. I'm sure you've experienced when you went through difficult periods where you didn't sleep a lot, you were more likely to get sick. That's the way it works. Immune system strengthens. Energy levels go up significantly when you sleep. And it's a myth that, well, if we sleep just the right amount, like 4 or 5 hours, like Clinton did, then we'll have the optimal level of energy. Simply not true. There are some people, the rare exceptions, you know, on the bell curve, who maybe can't sleep and function well with 4 or 5 hours, but overwhelming majority of people need between 7 and 10 hours of sleep. Also, in terms of weight, people who don't sleep enough go above their optimal weight level. People who exercise regularly and sleep well are more likely to meet their optimum weight level. Motor skills and accidents. Let me share with you some from the Department of Motor Vehicles, some statistics. According to them, 100,000 accidents per year are a result of lack of sleep. 100,000 accidents a year. 40,000 injuries in the workplace or on the road are a result of lack of sleep. And 1,500 deaths are a result of accidents that came as a result of lack of sleep. Also, stress and anxiety level, significantly higher. So it's a major cause of stress and anxiety when we don't get our fix of sleep. Depression, for a few reasons. First of all, because we're tired and we're cranky. I mean, all we need to do is look at a baby. When they're tired, they get cranky. It's natural. So we don't cry, but we still feel depressed, just the same as a baby does. It's even worse for us because at least the baby lets it out. We keep it in, right? The great deception, which leads to the great depression. Also, there's another interesting reason. Sleep researchers have found that we work through many of our problems, the issues that we go through the day, while we're asleep, which is why sometimes you go with a math problem, you go to sleep with a problem set at night, and you wake up with the answer, because your mind doesn't stop working when it's sleeping. And the same is not just done for math problems, it's also done for personal issues or challenges that we're facing. While we're asleep, we're working. And if we cut the sleep halfway, we're stopping an important process of resolving issues. In terms of dreams, you may recognize it in yourself. Dream researchers showed this. Early dreams, at the beginning of the night, are less pleasant than later dreams after 6 or 7 hours. And the reason is because at the beginning we're resolving tension and issues. And later on we've already resolved it. And if we cut it, let's say after 5 hours, when it's not fully resolved, it spills over these problems, these issues, and that leads to depression or higher levels of depression. Also, again, you don't need research to show this. Improved cognitive functioning improves significantly through sleep, and that includes short-term memory, as well as long-term memory, as well as speed of comprehension. All these things done have been done with rats all the way up to human beings with sleep deprivation. So some tips. First of all, the optimum is 8 hours a day. It may be different for different people. It may be 7 for you, it may be 10. Usually it's not outside that range, though there may be anomalies. Nap time is good. It's something that is natural. So if you just let people be in a room without any light, without any external stimulation, they will usually take a nap, even though they don't know what the time is, halfway through the day. So nap is good if you can have it. Many people don't have the luxury to do it. Also, and this is research done by Professor Nakayama here in the psychology department, if you don't sleep enough, and you know there are certain things you need to get done, and there are periods like that, such as when you have a baby, especially at the beginning, and let's say you sleep 4 hours a night, supplement it with a nap. A nap very often recharges us. Even a 10 or 20 minute power nap really does help. And again, you don't need research for that, but it's interesting that they show with brain scanning how the brain actually recharges during the nap. And for short periods of time, we're able to sustain ourselves for longer. And I say short periods of time because overall, we don't want to push it. We want to have the 8 hours of night sleep. Watch your exercise and food. Don't exercise too close to bedtime. It may make it difficult to fall asleep, not for everyone, but for some people. And also don't eat too heavy a meal just before going to sleep. This for me has been very important also in this area, permission to be human. Because very often, you know, we may go to sleep at midnight when we want it, but we are so worried and so stressed over the million things that we still need to do that we end up staying up for, you know, a few hours, and then we get even more upset because I could have been doing work now, and then it's a downward spiral. Give yourself the permission to be human. If you feel too stressed and you don't fall asleep, be stressed and don't fall asleep. Because it's like the white bear. Don't think of a white bear, don't think of a white bear. Don't stay up, don't feel anxious, don't do that, and you're experiencing just that. So give yourself the permission to be human. I've actually found some of my most creative ideas came during nights when I didn't fall asleep easily. And I just lay in bed thinking. Permission to be human. And finally, pay attention to internal rhythms. There is no one-size-fits-all here. There is no panacea. You may need 8 hours, you may need 7, you may need 10. You may be a late night person or an early morning person. Ask what works for you. Late night people, their natural rhythm is usually above 24 hours, which is why at night they feel like they can extend the day and it's very difficult for them to wake up in the morning. Early morning people, their natural rhythm is usually under 24 hours. So that they get up and they're ready to go because they've already actually been up for a while. At least the body was ready to be up, but then they get very tired late at night. So what is your natural rhythm? Don't try and fit into what most people do. I think I mentioned this before, you know, when I came here, I tried to fit in to the late night worker because most students, most of my friends, my roommates were working at night. And then I realized that I was a morning person and just started working in the morning and became so much more productive, more creative, and happier. So when they started to work at midnight often, I would be fast asleep and I would get up between 6 and 7 and get my work done. Pay attention to your internal rhythms. William Dennett, who is a professor at Stanford, has this to say. Effects of sleep deprivation on health and well-being have been documented by research. Cognitive skills and physical performance are impaired by sleep deprivation, but mood is affected even more. People who get less than a full night's sleep are prone to feel less happy, more stressed, more physically frail, and more mentally and physically exhausted as a result. Sufficient sleep makes us feel better, happier, more vigorous, and vital. So if I said to you, here is a drug, take it and you can have all these things, of course you would take it. It's here, it's free, it has no negative side effects. The final one. America as a country, according to Tiffany Field, who is a researcher, professor at the University of Miami, Americans are touch deprived. We generally use our other senses extensively. You know, we taste a lot, we smell, we perfume ourselves, it's important for us. But we don't touch enough. And touch helps when it comes to our physical health in terms of overcoming injuries, in terms of physical growth for children. It also affects our mental health. It's associated with, or lack of touch is associated with anxiety, with depression. Touch is associated with higher levels of well-being. And if that hasn't convinced you, it also improves our sex life. Marty Seligman has a great book out where he talks about interventions that work and those that don't. Because there are, you know, we've talked about numerous interventions in this class. What actually does work? Well, Masters and Johnson, who were sex therapists, their intervention works. It works on a few levels. First of all, for sexual dysfunctions, and also for getting people from having good sex to great sex. And one of their primary interventions is to put more focus on touch. They were writing their stuff back, you know, not long after the Kinsey report came out, the 60s, 70s, continues into the 80s and 90s. And what they said, they actually essentially talked about what everyone talks about, the importance of foreplay, but the importance of touch. And between 70 and 95%, depending on the studies you look at, of sexual dysfunctions or wanting to improve from better to great, it actually works with a very simple intervention, touching one another more, caressing, hugging. We need it. We need it. One of my favorite quotes, again, I don't think this is very scientific, but Virginia Satir has this to say. We need 4 hugs a day for survival. We need 8 hugs a day for maintenance. We need 12 hugs a day for growth. There's some truth to that. You see, there's actual research on touch and touch deprivation. For instance, finally, you get it. So, touch deprivation. Premature babies in incubators. They divided them into two groups. They were in the hospital for a month. One group received 45 minutes of massage a day. The second group didn't. They were taken care of. I mean, this was a, in other words, they were normal. And the other kids, additional 45 minutes of massage a day. The babies, the premature babies who were massaged every day for 45 minutes, their body weight increased 47% more. 47%, that's very significant for, especially for the preemies. 8 to 10 months later, there was a follow-up. The kids' cognitive functioning and physical ability was significantly better for those who were massaged. Now, you can't really do these studies in an experimental group with kids. In other words, deprive them of touch. But here are studies that were done with monkeys. Yeah, I mean, it's a real question. Where do you draw the line with ethics? But it was done nevertheless by Harry Harlow, a psychologist back in the 1960s. And he had two groups. One group, touch deprived, didn't hurt them or anything, gave them their food, everything they needed, but didn't allow their mother, you know, to cuddle them and touch them. The second group touched normally. The second group developed as expected. The first group displayed very strange symptoms. First of all, cognitively, they weren't as developed. They were underdeveloped. They displayed certain autistic behaviors. So they were sitting down on the floor with their hands here and just rolling back and forth, not wanting to interact. Unfortunately, this study was replicated on human beings in a natural experiment. This happened in Romania, where Ceausescu, when he was in power, put about 150,000 kids in orphanages. And these orphanages were oversubscribed, but he took them from their family, who were often dissidents, put them in the orphanage, and these kids were touch deprived. Their basic needs were taken care of. They got all the food that they needed, their diapers were changed, but because there was understaffing, they were not touched. They were not caressed. When Ceausescu's regime fell in 1989, these kids were liberated from these orphanages, and they displayed very similar symptoms to the ones that the monkeys displayed. They were between, first of all, between 7 to 10% of their peers in terms of size, so they were underdeveloped, just like the preemies who weren't massaged. They displayed the same kind of behavior, sitting in the side of the room, hugging their knees, and rolling. Many of them displayed autistic-like behavior because they were deprived of touch. And the beautiful thing about touch is that it's a win-win. When I touch someone, I'm automatically touched back. It's like happiness. When we make someone happy, we become happier ourselves. The ultimate currency. It's a positive-sum game as opposed to a zero-sum game. And at the same time, it's important to respect people's boundaries because not everyone feels comfortable with 12 hugs a day. Not everyone feels comfortable, you know, using their tactile sense. But over time, people can become more and more comfortable. Let me show you an example now of people's reactions to being hugged, or at least they think they're going to be hugged, by a stranger on the street. Ha ha ha! So the different comfort level. So here is what I prescribe. 30 minutes of aerobic exercise 3 times a week. 8 hours per 24 hours of sleep, and lots of hugs. See you on Thursday.